I'm George Liston, CA. During the 20th century, American society has been caught up in an ongoing debate about public art. The sculptures, paintings, murals, and mobiles selected to adorn our public spaces for commemorative or decorative purposes. Now, on one level, there's a clear conflict over aesthetic values, but this is also a dispute with important political dimensions. And as our culture wars consume increasing amounts of political energy, it's vital to understand what's at stake in these controversies over art, artists, and art agencies in this society. My guest is Casey Blake, Director of American Studies at Indiana University. Casey, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to be here.
Casey, it's a great topic. It's an extremely important topic, and I'd like to begin our conversation with looking at a recent and very important phase in the American public art argument. In the early 1960s, the modernist phase in public art was launched by the Kennedy administration. And since the basic question, Casey, is who decides what art goes where and why, I suppose I could start by asking you, what was the Kennedy administration's motivation in launching a modernist art phase?
Well, I think that the Kennedy administration played a very important role in establishing modernism as in some ways an official style for the federal government. The key members of the Kennedy White House who were concerned with arts policy, and I'm thinking here of August Heckscher and Arthur Schlesinger, were men who very much admired European modernism and I think hoped that the United States could somehow create an art that would hold its own against the standards set earlier in the century by major European modernist artists. These were men who believed that a major program of public monuments and architecture could do several things for the American public and for the United States abroad. First of all, they hoped that a program of public art would in some way uplift popular taste, that it would perhaps wean Americans off television and other forms of mass entertainment. They also hoped and believed that public art could somehow sustain Americans' morale during the Cold War. And the Cold War figured very prominently in all of their thinking about the arts in the early 1960s. They very much hoped that the arts could impress upon Americans the value of individual freedom. And they defined American arts policy in conscious opposition to the arts policies in place in the Soviet Union and other communist countries, where they believed the state essentially controlled the arts and dictated what kind of art artists would produce. So their whole approach to how the federal government ought to be sponsoring the arts was very much framed around the notion that artists should be given the utmost freedom to pursue their own personal vision. Mm-hmm. I'd also say that Heckscher, Schlesinger, and to some extent Kennedy himself, saw public art as an important part of a larger program for urban renewal in American cities. American cities were already showing the effects of the post-war exodus to the suburbs and to some extent of deindustrialization. And they believed that public artists ought to be working closely with architects and urban planners in renewing and reconstructing the downtowns of major American cities.
Right. So we get essentially three purposes here, don't we, Casey? We get a political statement about the nature of this society as opposed to the Soviet Union.
That's right.
The question of uplifting artistic standards among the general populace. And as you point out, finally, this notion of renewal of cities. Another aspect of this intrigues me, Casey. The Kennedy administration starting this, the type of art that was chosen, abstract art, modern art, do liberals begin to get identified with modernism at this point in a kind of continuing and perhaps ever more acute way?
Yes, I think so. I think it's important to realize just how unusual it was for the federal government to be sponsoring modernist art. Here you have the United States government in the midst of a Cold War with the Soviet Union, committing itself to a modernist cosmopolitan art as its official style. And liberals, not simply liberals within the Democratic Party, but also liberals like Nelson Rockefeller, who was a very important promoter of modern historian, and of course a Republican.
And a great collector.
Yes, exactly, and a great patron of the arts. Liberals within the Republican and Democratic parties are beginning in the early 1960s very much identify with modernist art.
Another important consideration, Casey, of course, is the method by which all of this was undertaken. I mean by that, the vehicle for commissioning art, for selecting artists, for deciding on locales, all that kind of thing. How was it done?
Well, the Kennedy administration recommended that decisions about funding for the arts, broadly conceived, be made by panels of specialists or experts in their respective fields. And this very much laid the groundwork for the panel system that was adopted by the National Endowment for the Arts when it was established in 1965 and by other government funding agencies for the arts. The idea here was that you would in some way insulate artists from political interference by the state by having the decisions about what art would be funded made not by government officials, but by other artists, art critics, museum curators, art historians, professionals who had credentials or were certified in some ways as having some expertise in the arts.
But what's missing from all that you've said, Casey, is local or lay participation.
I mean,
where does the place where the thing's going to end up get involved?
That's right. I think that very early on in the history of the modernist public art movement, you see a political problem insofar as decisions are being made in a very centralized way by a small elite group of professionals who are guided primarily by aesthetic criteria. And it's important to note that these are aesthetic criteria developed in private spaces, in museums, in galleries, in salons, and not really aesthetic criteria developed in response to some dialogue with local communities or with the public at large.
Is that what people call museum art culture or something?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think that one way of looking at the public art movement of the 1960s and to a large extent of the 1970s as well is as an attempt to place in public spaces objects that really have their origins in museum culture.
Right. Casey, is the crux then of the modernist art dispute, and the public art dispute in our society, the sense of growing public negative reaction to this or hostility over this period that lasted, I guess, about 20 years from 69 to, I guess, 89 or so?
Yes. There certainly is a backlash against modernist art in public places that sets in very clearly by the end of the 1970s and the early 1980s. But in fact, you can see early signs of public dissatisfaction with this whole approach to public art as early as the very first major commission that the NEA funded, the Alexander Calder sculpture La Grande Vitesse for Grand Rapids, Michigan, which was installed in 1969. There you had a process where the public had virtually no say whatsoever, either in the selection of Calder as the artist or in the design for the sculpture. And although the Calder sculpture is often pointed to as one of the great triumphs of the NEA and of the public art movement in the United States, there actually was a rather vigorous and interesting debate in Grand Rapids during the 2 years before its installation, where you see quite clearly that there is a good deal of unhappiness on the part of members of the public about this whole selection process and about the very idea of installing modernist art in public space.
You know, Casey, it's interesting also that the Calder sculpture was installed in 1969. There were some earlier storm warnings, weren't there? I mean, in 1966, there's another wonderful episode,
yes.
Wonderful in the sense of giving us something to think about. In Boston, was it not? With the placement of Robert Motherwell's, the painting of Motherwell's mural, New England Elegy.
Yes.
What was that all about?
Well, in 1966, the John F. Kennedy Federal Building in Boston, designed by Walter Gropius, opened, and it included in its interior lobby a large abstract mural by Robert Motherwell, one of the leading abstract expressionists of the post-war period. And as you mentioned, the title of the mural was New England Elegy, and it was clearly meant as a somber reflection on Kennedy's death and a kind of homage to Kennedy's presidency. What's interesting is that this abstract piece was immediately misinterpreted, first by an assistant curator, if I understand correctly, at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and later by journalists who believed that one corner of this abstract piece was a literal depiction of Kennedy's profile at the instant of his assassination in Dallas. Now, if you look at the mural, you realize that this kind of interpretation of the piece is somewhat of a stretch, but there is, in fact, one piece of the mural that might be read that way. Although Motherwell and others immediately responded by saying that this was incorrect, that it was an abstract, non-representational piece, the initial misinterpretation of the piece as somehow depicting Kennedy's assassination led to an enormous outcry from people in Boston who felt that this was a monstrosity, it was a blasphemous work, and that it was an insult to the memory of their beloved late president. Mm-hmm. What I find intriguing about this episode, which comes early on in the history of the modernist public art movement and very soon after the creation of the NEA, is that you see the politics of public art very clearly insofar as those people who supported the Motherwell mural, and I'm thinking here of the editors of the liberal Boston Globe, officials associated with the NEA, museum curators, art critics, and other artists, move very quickly to respond to public criticism of the Motherwell piece by saying, first of all, that the public is misinformed and that people who are ignorant of art historical traditions really should have no say about matters of this kind. And secondly, by trying to establish their own credentials and making it clear to everyone concerned that some members of American society ought to have more say about the works of art chosen for public places than others. They try to establish their credentials. They lecture the public, often in a very patronizing way, about the history of abstract expressionism. And in the process, I think, raise some very interesting questions about how public this kind of public art actually is. Mm-hmm. If, in fact, it's an art placed in public spaces, but an art in which the public really has no hand, either in its design or in its selection, then I think you have an interesting political question as to whether this is public art at all.
Excellent point. Casey, I guess we could say, in looking at a third example that comes after the 70s, toward the end of the 1980s, kind of the final climactic point in our choice of key points in this process, the public roars back in 1989. There's the placement of a piece called Tilted Arc in Lower Manhattan that provokes tremendous public protest and is moved from that site as a result. What's significant about all that?
Well, I think Tilted Arc is a decisive turning point in the history of public art in the United States, and I think that in some ways the controversy surrounding Tilted Arc, which occurred from 1981 when the piece was first installed to 1989 when it was removed by the General Services Administration, really marks the end of what I've come to consider the modernist moment in the history of American public art. It's important to realize, I should mention, that the controversy surrounding Richard Serra's minimalist steel sculpture was not unique. Let me say a little bit about that controversy and about the Serra sculpture. The Serra sculpture, for your listeners who do not remember this controversy, was a huge minimalist work made of Corten steel, about 120 feet long, 12 feet high and about an inch thick, which was a piece installed in a plaza outside of a federal building in Lower Manhattan near Foley Square that literally bisected the plaza and completely transformed the public space outside of what was a rather dreary 1960s style modernist office building. That public space had never been a very hospitable or appealing place to begin with. In fact, I think it's fair to say that it was a non-functional space almost from the outset, terribly designed, and not used for much more than an occasional lunch or for pedestrians to walk in and out as they were going to work or leaving work at the end of the day. But Serra's sculpture transformed the plaza and in many ways was designed deliberately as a challenge to the federal government as embodied in the architecture of the federal building in that space. It was a confrontational work. It was a work inspired in many ways by Serra's leftist politics, although it's not it was not recognizably ideological in the way that, say, social realist art is recognizably ideological. But Sarah, coming from the left, coming from a particular strain of political and aesthetic thinking on the left, wanted to disrupt public space in this part of Manhattan, wanted to challenge the authority of the federal government as embodied in its architecture, and in that regard was quite successful. The problem was that many of the people who worked in the office buildings in that area felt that Sarah was engaged in a kind of symbolic war with the federal government at their expense. And you start to see a very complex and very rich argument taking place throughout the 1980s about the Sarah sculpture.
So that sculpture was, in particular, was designed to be provocative.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Sarah, throughout the controversy, issued a number of public statements about what his work was about that were also, I think, intended as provocations of a sort. What I think is important about the Tilted Arc controversy is that in many ways the public, made up of federal employees and office workers in that area, was essentially silenced in the public debate as it was conducted in the media and in the courts and in other official forums. Mm-hmm. What you saw in those forums was a debate that should be very familiar to those of your listeners who have followed the culture wars of the last decade, in which on the one hand you had conservative politicians and pundits writing in newspapers and commenting on television, and on the other hand you had liberal art administrators and art critics and artists arguing about the fate of a sculpture and arguing about the fate of this particular public space without paying much attention to what people on the ground felt about the whole business.
That's very interesting.
What I've tried to do in my own work is actually attempt to understand how people in local communities have understood these works of art, how they've interpreted them and how they've responded to them. Okay. And I've done that by looking at documents that government officials and other members of elite groups tend to ignore. Letters to the editor, letters to politicians, petitions, a whole series of often anonymous interventions by people in local communities. Mm-hmm. If you look at those in the case of the Tilted Arc affair, and there were literally thousands of such documents that I was able to uncover, you find, in fact, that the people who worked in Federal Plaza had a very different view of the whole debate than what you might expect if your attention was riveted to what was going on in the media and to the arguments made by conservative politicians on the right and liberal artists and art administrators on the left.
That's striking, Casey. What you're saying to me is that on one very public and amplified level, there's this argument between the so-called or self-appointed opinion leaders, I suppose.
That's right.
That's completely divorced from what the masses or the bulk of people are.
Exactly.
Are thinking about these.
The conservative position on Tilted Arc, in a nutshell, was that this was an intervention by a liberal or leftist new class whose attitudes were formed during the 1960s and who were contemptuous of the country's guiding principles and the morality of ordinary Americans. And that this intervention destroyed what had been a beautiful and peaceful public space that had been previously enjoyed by what Speaker Gingrich calls normal Americans. On the other hand, the position articulated by many artists and art critics was, first of all, that this was a work of fine art produced by an artist whose credentials had been certified by a panel of experts who had selected him for this commission. And secondly, that the reaction against Tilted Arc came from reactionary know-nothings who were uninformed about the arts and who were taking out on the sculpture their anxieties and their alienation.
But, you know, okay, I have to jump in on
yes.
that because just listening to that account, it just seems to me like both sides gloriously missed the point.
Yes,
The conservatives in that argument are presenting a kind of a pastoral beauty that really never existed. You said it was an ugly space originally.
That's right.
And the artist is saying the people who are using it are just too ignorant to know what's good for them.
That's right. And moreover, that they have somehow been so deluded by conservatives that they are taking out all their frustrations about modern society on art and on this particular sculpture. In fact, what I found as I made my way through the petitions, letters, and other documents filed by the people who worked in this area was a very different position than what either one of these elite groups articulated. Again and again, the people who wrote these letters and petitions argued that, first of all, they were competent to make judgments about art in public places. This was a very important issue for them. They understood clearly that the selection process that had led to the installation of Tilted Ark assumed that ordinary people had no knowledge whatsoever about the arts, and it was very important in these letters for these people to assert that they had the cultural competence required to intervene in some way in the process. Secondly, they understood very clearly what Sarah was up to. They understood that this was a political work. But as I said before, they felt it was a political act at their expense.
Right.
They pointed out repeatedly that Federal Plaza was an inhuman space before the arrival of Tilted Ark, and that Tilted Ark had only made it worse. And they, I think, also made a very interesting argument linking up the lack of power they had to make decisions about the public space outside of these federal office buildings with the lack of power they felt they had inside the buildings. Again and again, you see employees saying, not only are we not asked what kind of art should go in the plaza outside our office building, but we're not given any say whatsoever in matters that are of importance to us in our jobs.
You literally took the words right out of my mouth. As you described this, I began to think, this is really an argument about power.
Exactly. I think at bottom, it really was an argument about power.
Right.
And I should also say that what's striking about the letters and petitions I read is how thoughtful many of these people were about what sorts of changes they thought ought to be made in a space like this. Mm-hmm. One finds many suggestions, for example, for a kind of park space or for other changes that would somehow humanize what was really a very unfriendly environment and make it possible for people to use those spaces in some social or collective way.
Casey, as we come to the conclusion of our conversation, I'm moved to ask you the question that strikes me as the most pertinent one. Perhaps it's this simple. Can we have public art in the society? And if so, how? Under what terms? And to clarify that a bit, are there lessons in this modernist art controversy that should guide what we do about public art in future?
Yes, I think that what I'd like to say by way of preface is that not only can we have public art, but we must have public art in this country. And I say that because in spite of all the criticisms that I and others have made of the modernist movement in American public art, one of the most admirable elements of that movement was its commitment to public space, and with that, a commitment to a public culture shared by Americans of all backgrounds. And I'm very distressed by accounts that one sees in the press and in a good deal of scholarly literature that suggest that our country is moving away from a commitment to public space, that we're witnessing a radical and dramatic privatization of space. If you look, for example, at the construction industry, it's very alarming to see that the leading sectors of that industry are in prison construction and in the construction of gated communities. And I think that tells us something very disturbing about our own time and our movement away from public space and from the very idea of a shared public culture. So I think we've got to continue to have a strong commitment to public art, and that such public art will require some kind of public subsidy, either from the federal government or from local governments. But I believe that public artists and public art administrators have learned an awful lot from the collapse of the modernist movement in the early or mid-1980s. They've thought long and hard about the lessons to be learned from the Tilted Ark affair. And there are a number of very encouraging signs that suggest that a new kind of public art is being created that is inclusive and participatory and very much responsive to local conditions and local cultures. Let me give you a couple of examples. First of all, it's very clear to me that one major strain of the contemporary public art movement is responsive to multiculturalism and seeks in some way or another to represent the traditions resources and aspirations of minority groups in this country. A good example of such artwork would be the really remarkable Great Wall of Los Angeles that Chicana muralist Judy Baca has done over the course of almost 10 years in Los Angeles. That's a work that she did with the collaboration and participation of local people from the immediate surrounding areas in Los Angeles, and a work that depicts, over the course of many panels, the history of ethnic and racial minorities in that city over the course of a century or more. Another example of this new attentiveness to local context and participation can be seen in the efforts by public artists to use public art as a way to tell stories about local history in public spaces. There's a lot of very interesting and very moving public art being made by artists who want to use public space in order to remind citizens of their own history, and in particular to remind citizens of the history that's been obscured or physically obliterated by the transformations of American cities over the course of the last 50 years. And then finally, I'd say that there is a very interesting and I think very hopeful effort on the part of a good many public artists to think about what they do not so much in terms of plopping fine art objects in public spaces, but as an effort to work with local communities to reconstruct and humanize public spaces so that they can be used for collective and civic purposes. And although no one can predict what the future will bring, my sense is that in the aftermath of the modernist moment, we're going to see a lot more public art created along these lines.
That's excellent. Casey Blake, thank you very much for being with us today on Dialogue. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Casey Blake. I'm George Distancia, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. Our production assistant is Megan Conway. And our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.